From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula.
Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. I am Kyle Ferrier, and I will be your guest host today. I am joined by Jean Lee, a veteran foreign correspondent covering North Korea and currently a global fellow at the Wilson Center and a CNN contributor. Jean is with me to discuss her new book for KEI entitled Soap Operas and Socialism, dissecting Kim Jong-un's evolving policy priorities through TV dramas in North Korea. Thanks for joining me today, Jean.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get started on your paper, I have to say your ability to decipher North Korean propaganda is just uncanny. I think in the presentation you mentioned that you were a forensic anthropologist when it comes to these sort of things. Where and how did you learn to do this?
I have been looking at North Korean propaganda now for a decade. So I was posted to South Korea, to the AP Seoul Bureau, and I have to say when I first started reading KCNA, the state news agency, it sounded hysterical all the time. So you have to learn, it's a skill to learn how to read North Korean propaganda, learn how to read state media, but watch it. So honestly, I was like a North Korean when I was there in the sense that all the media that I had access to was North Korean. So in the evenings, we were watching North Korean movies, watching North Korean TV. So I saw a lot of it. So you learn how to decipher it. And also, I really had my staff, my North Korean staff, to help me. They were really my tour guides to the propaganda, explaining what everything was and the significance of it. So I think it takes practice as a skill and having somebody explain it. And also seeing how it compares to life on the ground helps you decipher the propaganda and also really isolate what's important about it and what it says.
You've cultivated that skill set for this paper that you've done for us. And you, in this paper, you look at four TV dramas looking to see where the propaganda lies in them. Now, can you just give a brief overview of the four plots of the TV dramas before we get into the propaganda behind them?
So I picked four dramas, one from 2013, one from 2014, one from 2015, and one that was from last year, 2016. And I wasn't particularly looking for dramas that were similar, but one thing that I noticed in all of them was that they featured young characters, and this is something that is really a policy priority for Kim Jong-un. It turned out also that they had some recurring themes, so they worked out thematically. So one of them features a sports star, and that's something that the North Koreans are really trying to promote, sports. One of them features these middle schoolers these teenagers who are science whizzes, right? And that's something that they're clearly trying to cultivate, all these computer experts / hackers. And also we've got a military officer who's a graduate of the Naval Academy, and then a typical North Korean family. So we've got sort of four archetypes of who Kim Jong-un really wants to speak to, right? So the family, the military officer, the sports star, the students. All of these characters are fairly young. We see a lot of youth. And this is a way for North Korea to reach that population and to appeal to that population. Unfortunately, I think we have that same problem in Hollywood where it's like you want to have these ingenues, right? You want to have young characters that everybody wants to look at. You want eye candy. And I think that's what's happening in North Korea today as well.
Now, how is this different from what we saw under Kim Jong-il? When I think of the Kim Jong-il era, I think of these large operas dedicated to Juche ideology and Kim Il-sungism. And what really explains this shift between the dramas that you're mentioning and the films of the Kim Jong-il days?
One of the things that I'm noticing is the emphasis on family, which I find interesting because certainly under Kim Jong-il, it was all about putting Kim first, putting the state first, putting the military first, and in a sense, putting your family second. And we're seeing a shift under Kim Jong-un, where there's a lot of emphasis on family and community. And that's, I think, significant. I kind of have been looking at China as an example. How did the family structure fall apart under the Cultural Revolution when they tried to put the state first? How did the social fabric of the family, how was that disrupted by that kind of a social movement? And likewise, in North Korea, how did this period of rule where it was military first, state first under Kim Jong-il, how did that affect the traditional family structure in North Korea, and what were the consequences? And I'm only looking at that because there's so much of an emphasis on the family now in North Korea. So many of the dramas, like the most popular movie of last year was called Story of My House or Story of My Family. So many of the dramas, the narratives in the dramas that I analyzed were about family. So that's different. So they're saying, put your family first. The party comes first, but put your family first as well. Restore those bonds. Remember that you're connected to everybody else. Be good to the people around you. And the next step is trying to figure out why that's so important to the current regime.
Do you have any thoughts as to, any personal opinions as to why that might be so important?
I do think that the traditional structure was upended by this emphasis on military first. They went through a really tumultuous period in the mid-90s with famine. So many people died. Kim Jong-il put himself, it was partly to establish his authority, put himself forward as a father figure. He treated the North Korean people almost, he wanted them to think of themselves as orphans because Kim Il-sung had died, who was their father, and to see him as a surrogate father figure. Many of them did lose their parents in the famine. And to put him first over their own families. And so I wonder if that meant that that social structure kind of disintegrated a bit. One of the things that I look at in these dramas is the high number of, there's a repeated thematic narrative of children running away. And I think this is so fascinating. And I wonder if that is meant to address defection. Now, before I do include in my paper some figures, the South Korean government tracks defections to South Korea, obviously. Before 1997, which is when Kim Jong-il technically formally took power, there were very few defections. After he became leader, that number jumped up dramatically, with the highest number being in, I believe, 2009. And this, we've heard, is something that has really upset Kim Jong-un. He does not like the rise in defections. It's something that he's clearly trying to tackle. One of the ways that the North Korean regime and the propagandists have tried to tackle this is by emphasizing family ties. One of the things that they've been doing is when they have a high-profile defection is to get the family members of those defectors on state TV to plead with their children to come back home. And in a strange way, we're seeing that being addressed in the dramas through these children who are running away. And the repeated lesson in these dramas is, we know you feel like you're not understood. There are things you want that you feel like you can't have. But if you run away, your family's going to worry about you. You're putting your family, you're panicking them. So I can't help but wonder if it's a sort of indirect way of addressing defections.
While we're on the topic of defections, while I was editing your paper, I noticed that the Anna Fifield Washington Post article that came out where she interviewed about 25 North Korean escapees, there were some complementary themes along family ties and sort of this disillusionment with the state to leave the country and to escape. And part of that disillusionment came from realizing that the good life that was promised to them wasn't necessarily attainable. Was there an element of not just talking about family values in these dramas, but also an element of trying to convey to the North Korean general North Korean populace that if you follow these values that the party would like you to follow, that there is a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow?
Precisely. Well, media in North Korea is propaganda. The movies, the TV dramas are propaganda. These TV dramas are kind of advertisement for the Workers' Party. You know, North Koreans do watch these because they need to know how to behave in order to reach that pot of gold or to get closer to it. And this is just a much more engaging way if you wrap it up in a story with pretty clothes and pretty apartments. But the what we're, you know, their system is a little bit different than ours, our capitalist system. For them, in order to get the perks, the sort of creature comforts, you have to win that through the party. That is all kind of rewarded through the party. So, for example, if you're an Olympic athlete who brings home gold, you are going to be rewarded with an apartment. Or the other perks that we might associate with, say, a job that brings us a lot of money. So it's a little bit different. Political capital is the most important currency in North Korea. So these dramas are, in a sense, a way to advertise the kind of life that might await them if they follow through with these party objectives. Whether or not that happens in reality is a whole other issue, and I think that speaking to recent defectors about their disillusionment is certainly a way to keep that propaganda in check or get a reality check on it. But certainly they're trying to promote the idea that if you are loyal to the party and you exceed the quotas, then you will be rewarded.
I'd like to take just more or less a half a step back. There has been a lot going on in North Korea recently, and none of it has been related to these dramas, but I feel like these dramas provide an extra layer of insight to help one of the big questions that we have, which is, what is the true purpose of North Korea's nuclear program? That is to say, is it primarily to serve as an effective deterrent against the United States, or is it tied to domestic cohesion and stability? And finding an answer to this has real ramifications, as there is likely more room for the nuclear program to be negotiated away if its purpose is to face an external threat than if Kim Jong-un is using it as a tool to bolster his political legitimacy at home. And some of the findings in your paper suggest that the missile program, the nuclear program, are directly tied to bolstering support at home, vis-a-vis some of the clips that you showed of people dancing around the television in 2012 in December when North Korea launched its ICBM then. So with this in mind, what would you say the implications of your paper are, or the findings of your paper are, for the U.S. as we try to deal with a North Korea that is said is now a full-fledged nuclear state after the latest ICBM test?
I think it's always important to look not only at what the North Koreans are trying to tell us in the outside world, but also what they're trying to tell their own people. And I do think that it's not just the nuclear deterrent, but also, as you said, that Kim Jong-un is using the nuclear program to bolster his legitimacy. He's a young guy, so he wants to show his people that he can defend them. But he also has this two-track policy of building nuclear weapons and boosting the economy. And frankly, it seems to be doing that. So their economy seems to be growing. There's more productivity because they're building. It's created a whole industry, right? And so we have to keep that in mind, because it's not just about dealing with the U.S. It's also trying to bolster his legitimacy at home. Seeing in the dramas how important these programs are kind of underlines that, right? So that's why I find it useful. I think that also, we tend to look at the provocations as a message they're trying to send us to the U.S. But you can see in the dramas that there might also be a domestic timeline. For example, there's one particular scene in Our Neighbors where, as you mentioned, they're dancing around the TV. That is a scene that's really important to keep in mind, because that happened a week before the anniversary of Kim Jong-il's death. And likewise, we should just consider that timing this year as well, that there may be another provocation in the lead up to that anniversary. It's just something, another element to keep in mind. And we tend to, I think, look at things in terms of what are they trying to say to us in the U.S.? But actually, there's also that internal audience. That scene where they're dancing around the TV also really gives us a sense of how proud the regime is of this program and how much of their identity is built around it. And so that means it's not something they're going to give up very easily.
And before we wrap things up, is there anything else that we didn't get to discuss today that you think would be good for our listeners to know?
I think that most of the scholarship on North Korean media has really been focused on the Kim Jong-il era. There hasn't been that much focused on looking at North Korean media today, but there has been quite a shift in policy. And so I'm hoping that this paper will encourage students and researchers and academics to look at North Korean media today rather than relying on past scholarship. I did mention in my presentation that some of the recent sanctions in the U.S. that have prompted YouTube to take down or cancel accounts that gave us access to North Korean state media are really damaging to the work that we do in trying to understand North Korea. So I know some people have spoken about this, and I want to throw my voice in there as well, that if you don't think that that access is helpful to us, then you don't understand journalism and you don't understand research. So I find it's getting harder and harder for us to access information about North Korea, and that means another avenue to information is going to be shut off from us. And it's just going to mean that it's going to be harder for us to understand who they are, what they want, and how to deal with them. So I would like to throw my voice in and just say we need to be able to see this media, and those who are trying to block it just don't understand how important it is to future policymaking and research on North Korea.
Yeah, we know so little about the North Koreans. Why would we intentionally try and cut ourselves off from an area of more information that could provide fruitful information?
And I think likewise, you know, when I was the AP bureau chief, there was certainly a lot of criticism from certain quarters that people who didn't want us going into North Korea. If you don't think that journalists should try to be on the ground, then you don't understand journalism. We cannot just report on North Korea from the outside. We have to get in on the ground on a regular basis. I'm so grateful that I spent so much time there, that I was able to spend weeks on end, because there's no correspondent right now, no American correspondent who is able to spend that much time in North Korea right now. And that means our coverage suffers and our understanding of North Korea suffers because of it. So this is something that I think is going to be harmful to our understanding, and it's going to hurt our game, frankly, when it comes to dealing with North Korea.
Well, thank you very much, Jean, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for once again joining us here on Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. As always, please remember to subscribe to our podcasts, and also subscribe to KEI's content on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us by searching Korea Econ Inst on Twitter and by searching for the Korea Economic Institute on Facebook. We also have a YouTube page and an Instagram, so be sure to check those out as well. And definitely come back next week for another great episode.